Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a unique feature of the world's oceans that we have to learn to live with. Most of us don't have any idea what's happening in the deep and mysterious depths of the seas. And yet, radical changes are taking place almost everywhere. Up until now, it was difficult to really grasp the nature and extent of these changes. In just a moment, we talk with Dr. Ben Halpern, who provides an interpretation of what his new ocean maps have to share. That's coming up. Stay tuned. Microsoft is about to unveil its worldwide telescope that will allow you to explore the entire universe from your computer screen. Of course, Google Sky has had a similar option available to its Google Earth users. It's truly amazing that we can see to the ends of the universe and make it all available. But unfortunately, here on Earth, we are still relatively blind to the truths of our oceans. Uncovering the truth of their secrets is still a long way off, but we make progress as we can. This past week, a study by a team of ocean scientists resulted in a unique map that provides a detailed analysis of the state of the world's oceans. And it's quite a startling picture that emerges. One of the things that concerns me most, there's so many different aspects of what's happening on this planet, but what's happening to the oceans, it's really quite a story. And I try to cover different angles on this all the time. Recently, there's been a very interesting and very significant study that puts together a lot of information in a map form, which becomes instantaneously interpretable. And I think that that's really useful. One of the principals who's helped to put this particular map together is now going to join us, Dr. Ben Halpern. He's a marine ecologist at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Halpern, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, give us a concept of this map, just the basic outline, and then we'll go into it more in depth.
Our project focused on trying to finally get kind of the big picture of how humans are affecting the oceans overall, sort of cumulatively, rather than just focusing on a particular activity. So people may have heard about the impacts of commercial fishing or climate change or land-based pollution alone, and those stories are important to tell and understand, but they don't give you the full picture. And we really wanted to understand, when you lay these things on top of each other, one on top of another, what does that do? What does that show us about how humans are affecting the oceans? And that's what we were able to do with these analyses.
That is such a powerful format. I've utilized that at various times in my life to study different things, different ecosystems and the various parameters. And it tells such an incredible story that you can't figure out with numbers.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's too much going on for people to really kind of pull together in their head, because each stress has its own way of affecting each ecosystem differently. And that's just too much for us all to pull together. And so what we did is provided the framework and the tools for pulling that all together, so that, as you pointed out, you can very quickly just look at this map and immediately get a sense of a meaningful understanding and estimate of the impact that humans are having on the ocean.
You've actually been able to put this into a visual form where the Earth is rotating, and you're able to kind of take a little quick tour around the planet and see the effects. You kind of interpret this in a variety of different parameters in terms of the effects.
There's a couple aspects of what we did that I think are important to point out. One is we looked at data that covered the entire planet, so that we had the full global scope. But we looked at fairly high-resolution data so that we could understand what's going on in each part, specific part of the ocean, and compare it to every other part of the ocean. So we get a relative estimate of how one area is doing compared to another. And a key part of being able to do that was another aspect of the research, where we accounted for the way that marine ecosystems respond differentially to different stresses or different human activities. So, for example, nutrient input has been shown to be a big problem for coral reefs, But it's not nearly as big of a problem for, say, soft sediment, shallow areas, which is another ecosystem type. And the fact that they respond differently is important to capture, and that's exactly what we did in our analyses. So we can look at the global statistics, how much of the ocean is being affected by human activities and the condition of that, and that's one thing we did. We can also compare how ecosystems are doing relative to other ecosystems. So what are the most threatened ecosystems? What are the most impacted ecosystems? So we were also able to do that.
And in terms of that analysis, why don't you give us the categories of threat?
We had 17 different human activities or impacts of human activities that range from climate change to commercial fishing to land-based pollution to invasive species, etc. There are areas that are heavily impacted by most of these, including many of the coastal areas near large human populations. And in these areas, like the North and Northern Seas and the South and East China Seas, along the eastern seaboard of the United States and the Eastern Caribbean, along the coast of India and Sri Lanka, these areas all have very high impact from the collection of human activities. And in these areas, the oceans are fairly heavily degraded and, you know, and nothing like what one might consider a natural state for the ocean. But there are places where very few of these impacts occur, and these places are what we call areas of very low impact. I wouldn't call them pristine, probably, because we found that no single spot on the planet is untouched by any human activities. And so there are places that have very low impact. We found about 3.5% of the oceans falls into this category of very low impact. A lot of that is in the poles, where people tend to not go for the most part. But there are scattered little patches of very low impact waters around the world. Most countries have at least some of this area that's in very low impact. And on the maps, it shows up as blue. Mm-hmm. We've color-coded it so you can quickly capture, you know, visually the impact we're having. The most heavily impacted places are the bright red ones.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And they show up very clearly, and it makes sense. You'll find, as I looked at the map, for example, that, of course, the eastern seaboard of the United States, the area around England and then Norway surprised me. It seemed as if the coastal areas of Norway, am I interpreting the map correctly with that?
That's right. So the North and Norwegian Sea, which is up around Norway and Great Britain, there's a lot of oil and gas development in those waters. There's a lot of very large ports and a lot of land-based pollution from the continent of Europe that runs off into those waters that bring in invasive species, and there's heavy commercial fishing up in those areas. So a lot of those oceans and that water up there has been heavily affected by many different human activities.
I always think of Norway as one of those pristine areas, the fjords, and but apparently, particularly on the western coast, that certainly is not the case.
Yeah, well, that's at least what our analyses show. So, I mean, you know, one thing is our analyses don't allow someone to zoom into a tiny, tiny patch of water, say, off the backyard of your vacation home, and it's here. You know, that's too fine a scale for what we've done. And so there very well may be some very small patches up in that part of Norway that are still in good shape. But in the bigger picture, that general area has been heavily affected by human activities.
And then, of course, most of the coastal regions of China, which also then embraces Japan, are heavily impacted as well. That would be expected.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably not too much of a surprise.
No, not at all. Well, if you were to look at the whole picture, what sort of an analysis of the state of the oceans based on this wonderful study that you've done?
Well, I'd say it's both alarming and encouraging. It's alarming because there's so much of the area that's been heavily impacted. We found 41% of the oceans is in a heavily impacted state. That's a lot of area for what is a very vast resource. The oceans are huge, and yet we've affected such a large part of it. That's kind of the alarming and surprising and worrisome message from our results. Where the encouragement and opportunity comes in is that as you look at the map, you'll see that it's not one big uniform blob of impact. There's a lot of spatial pattern to it, and that pattern provides opportunity because it means that there are places that are more and less impacted within any particular region. So a single country, no matter how small of an area they have of the oceans, has opportunity to set aside parts that are less impacted or think about ways to better manage those areas that are more impacted. And our results provide a lot of information for how you can move forward with better, more intelligent ocean management to allow for all these activities to continue to occur, but in a way that doesn't affect the oceans as much.
Were you able to discern from the study the top three impacts on the oceans?
Yes, we did do that, and there's two ways to ask that question. One is just how much of the ocean is being affected by it, and the other is how large is the impact. It's the latter one that we find to be a bit more interesting, and it really depends also on what you're focused on. If you look globally, by far the largest impact is coming from climate change, and we measured that through three ways: ocean acidification, changes in sea surface temperature, and increases in UV radiation. And all three of those are having very large impacts globally. But if you focus just on coastal waters, which is a meaningful thing to do because most of the things that we get from the ocean that we care about, fish, clean water, biodiversity, all these things that people often value in the oceans, comes mostly from coastal waters. And if you look at coastal waters, climate change is still a major driver of impact in these waters, but most of the other 17 impacts that we looked at are also having a very large impact on these coastal waters. So land-based pollution and nutrient runoff become major players in causing degradation in the coastal waters. Commercial fishing, artisanal fishing, all of these are having significant impact on coastal waters.
In terms of climate change, there is this issue of the rising ocean temperatures, but as well that then interacts with the increasing carbon dioxide levels in the air, which kind of has a multiplicative effect. Were you able to document any of those areas where that may be actually occurring more than others?
Well, it's actually a really important point you raised that, you know, it's really hard to account for those kinds of interactions because, for the most part, very little is currently known about them. So we, in our models, assumed everything was just additive, so you just sum everything up. But like you point out, there's plenty of, at least initial evidence, that things interact to multiply their effect. So our results are probably conservative, and things in the oceans are probably worse even than we found in our maps. But we weren't able to explicitly account for those just because so little is known, both about the types of interactions and then the spatial pattern of where those interactions are happening.
One of the things that was so much in the news probably 3-4 years ago were the impacts on the coral reefs. And for some reason, that I guess because there's so many other things now that we're becoming aware of, but the impact on coral reefs seems to have disappeared from the media and our awareness. What is the status, based on your studies, of coral reefs right now?
It is of grave concern, and our analysis confirmed that globally, coral reefs and mangroves, which also get a lot of attention, are heavily, heavily impacted ecosystems. But what we found is that other ecosystems are even more impacted than those, and they're ones that people may not really pay attention to much or even think about.
Well, let's talk about those, because I think it's important for us to talk about those things we don't otherwise pay attention
right.
to.
So ecosystems that came out as even more impacted than coral reefs include rocky reefs, which are in primarily in temperate waters. There, you get them a lot off the coast of California here. Often they have kelp forests on them, but when they don't, they're called rocky reefs. They're very diverse, they're very productive, and also very impacted. And even more impacted and more important are the continental shelves. And this is the part of the ocean as the continents drop off. It's at about 200 to 500 feet deep, and in these areas, it's where a lot of the fisheries productivity occurs, where a lot of gas, oil and gas development occurs out in the ocean. These areas are really productive for a lot of the resources that we get out of the oceans, but they're also very heavily impacted by human activities. They're the most impacted ecosystems on the planet.
You know, I saw a rather interesting photograph and story recently about images being picked up off of Google Earth from the satellite imagery, which really showed literally the tracks of some of the bottom trawling, literally the pathways in some of the shallower areas, particularly off the coast of Louisiana. And it was dramatic, but even more so was the image of the mud cloud, the sediment that was stirred up in massive areas as a result of that, that people hadn't been paying attention to, and it was very graphically portrayed. What about the effects of bottom trawling, which I consider to be immoral, one of the most reprehensible things we're doing to the planet right now, but I'm just curious what your studies were showing in terms of their impact.
Well, yeah, we included that as one of the layers in our analyses, and it's definitely both widespread and has a very heavy impact where it does occur. So as you alluded to, the practice of bottom trawling, for the most part, drags big, heavy nets across the bottom and pretty much destroys everything in its path. It's not complete, of course, but it really gets a lot of stuff. And when it's dragged over the sediment, the soft bottom, you get these plumes of sediment that you saw in those images. And there are a lot of consequences, not just from the direct impact, but then that sediment settles back down and buries animals that makes it hard for them to live. So there's a lot of consequences to bottom trawling fishing that do make it one of the most damaging impacts of human activities on the ocean.
Do you think in the future we're going to see some ability to limit this? Now, maybe you actually enlighten me on this one, because I don't know the answer to this. In terms of where bottom trawling primarily is taking place, because I heard an estimate of perhaps 10,000 different vessels that are involved in bottom trawling. It shocked me. But do you know where most of that is taking place, in the deeper waters, the shallower waters? Where would a person find it mostly?
The trawl fishermen don't want to drag their nets over really rocky bottom because it destroys the nets. So they, for the most part, try to focus on the soft bottom areas. And there actually are very large no-trawl zones being set up in various parts of the U.S. in order to try to limit where and how much trawl fishers drag their nets. But you're right. I've heard that same number of about 10,000 boats. They, you know, that's a lot of boats going over a lot of area, but they often go over the same area many times within a year. And so that means those areas are just being hammered, but it also means that there are places that are not being affected by trawl fishers. It's a very spatially patterned activity that the fishermen, you know, choose where to go to avoid damaging their nets and also where the fish are, and then there are also regulations to try to control where it goes on.
Well, in the open waters, that's the difficulty, is enforcement. It's just a challenge that's going to have to be done pretty much on a global basis here. And, yeah, your thoughts on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, once you get outside the EED, the exclusive economic zone of countries, which goes out to 200 nautical miles, it's international water, and there are very few regulations for what goes on out there, not just for fishing, but for all types of activities. And it's really hard to enact laws. I mean, the whaling treaty that we often hear about is an example of something that's tried to be managed through international law because so much of it happens out in international water, and there are major challenges with that. So, you know, fishing, the boats that exist now for commercial fishing, some of them are massive. They're these industrial-scale boats, and the nets can be miles long, so that you can both in surface distance, but also they can go miles deep and, you know, drag the bottom of oceans in very deep areas. So there's very little part of the ocean that can escape the pressures of fishing as well as other activities, and that there is a real need for a strong international will, a multilateral movement to get some sort of better management of these international waters, because otherwise they're just going to continue to be really heavily impacted by humans.
I so much appreciate talking with you, Dr. Halperin, because this is such an issue for me. One of the things that I keep hearing, and I certainly would like your perspective on this, is that to a large degree, the large adult fish in the ocean are very much gone right now. How would you interpret that story that we hear?
I think that there's probably a lot of truth to it. I mean, all you have to do is read some of the historical accounts of what the oceans used to look like. If you go back to ship logs from the 1700s or earlier, for parts of the Caribbean Sea or out in the open Pacific, and the tales are of just vast abundance of all sorts of fish and sea turtles and whales. I mean, it's numbers of animals that I think people can't possibly imagine the oceans having now, because we just don't see it anymore. And so, you know, we've had a profound impact on the abundance of most of the big fish and mammals and organisms in the oceans. There are very few that are at their historic levels. And so it's hard for us to imagine what a pristine ocean actually probably once looked like.
I can recall when I was living in Oregon, had a friend who was a venture capitalist, and he was very much involved in fishing there. And through the years that I knew him, he became very depressed because his whole sector, in terms of the fishing in that area, disappeared because they had been fished out. We're kind of facing those types of issues, and I'm concerned now as we look into the future as China in particular and Japan goes more modern, and the capacity to meet their needs. They're a very fish-intensive society. Are people beginning to think about what that could mean?
Well, you're exactly right, and unfortunately, they're already doing that. I mean, China is notorious for its international fishing fleet that goes around to a lot of places. There's a big, what they call, live fish trade in China, where the people there really like to be able to walk into a restaurant and see a fish tank with a fish alive swimming in it, point to it, and then eat that particular fish. It's very, very popular. The problem is that to bring fish live to a restaurant, you often only can, you have like a 90% mortality rate along the way, so you end up having to catch 10 times as many fish in order to supply that live fish trade. So the Chinese fishing fleets are everywhere, especially throughout Southeast Asia and into the Southern Oceans, just collecting huge numbers of fish for this, for a very, very large population that likes to eat live fish in the live fish trade. So it's already a major problem, and you're right that as they become a more and more developed society with more and more people with disposable income to participate in the live fish trade and eating these fish, it's going to become a larger problem.
I can only hope that as China really joins the 21st century, that they really join the 21st century and take on the responsibility as well. What I would like to know is now that you've done the study, what do you hope to accomplish? What do you hope that people can take from this and how it can be utilized to help restore and perhaps find new ways of resolving these dilemmas?
Well, that's a great question, and it's something that we've thought a lot about, and it was a key motivation for our work. You know, we are working to collaborate with policymakers both at state and federal levels in the United States to try to help think about our results and how they can affect and influence state and federal policy for ocean management. So that's something that we're trying to do within our own ranks, but we really hope that people who see this work, both get a better understanding of the impact that all of us are having on the oceans, but also understand that there's some personal responsibility behind this, that everything we do, from what kinds of fish we eat, how much fish we eat, what we throw away, how we throw it away, whether or not we recycle, all of these things can have an impact and do have an impact on the ocean. Just because we do it on land doesn't mean that it has no effect on the ocean. So there's a lot of opportunity for personal choice and personal responsibility to really change how we view the oceans and how we treat the oceans, and with that personal change, hopefully will come a new movement of better conservation and better management of our oceans.
One of the great stories that I hear about on a regular basis is that with the establishment of certain fish sanctuaries, for example, that the ocean has a terrific capacity to restore itself relatively quickly and effectively, at least in the certain species.
Well, that's exactly right, and actually I've spent a lot of my career studying that exact question. So if you look around the world, when you set up what they call marine reserves or no-take marine reserves, where you stop fishing within the boundaries of this park, essentially, like we have on land, but they're in water, when you do that, there's very rapid, very significant increases in the abundance and biomass of the fish and invertebrates that are inside the marine reserves. So for some species, this can happen within a few years. Others, it can take longer if they're very slow-growing, long-lived species. But in almost every single case that we've seen around the world, and there are hundreds of cases, we see these significant increases. And so you're right, it gives us real hope that if you just give the oceans a chance to heal, they will do it.
And there are some great examples, and it's becoming somewhat fashionable around the world in some areas.
Well, it's not even just fashionable. It makes sense. I mean, I think people are becoming more aware of the need for conservation, but there's increasing evidence that this isn't just a conservation tool, that it can also benefit fishermen and a lot of other stakeholder groups that are interested in using the oceans for various reasons. So there's a real potential for a win-win situation here where the oceans win and people win by setting up these no-take marine reserves.
We're talking with Dr. Ben Halpern, who's a marine ecologist with the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at UC Santa Barbara. Dr. Halpern, if people want to find out more about your amazing study, what's the best way for them to find you?
Well, we have a website that provides all of the maps and data that we use that people can browse around and also explains what we did, and also you can get the paper that we published. And the website is also a bit of a mouthful, but it's www.ncea.ucsb.edu/globalmarine, all one word.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. Maybe sometime in the future, I'd like to continue a conversation, particularly about some of as I've referred to them as sanctuaries. That would be really fascinating.
That would be great.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for your time.
I'll be posting a new Wild Side News update on YouTube this week. Be sure to see me there. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth rings true around the world here on the Wild Side News.